Our show is supported by Be My Guest with Ina Garten, Ina's official podcast from Food Network, back for its fourth season. On every episode, Ina invites a different friend to her home in the Hamptons to talk about life, love, and career, all while cooking up an amazing meal. Join Ina as she crafts a classic cocktail with journalist Frank Bruni and discusses the ins and outs of Yorkshire pudding with actress Emily Mortimer. If you're looking for great conversations about and over good food, tune in to Be My Guest with Ina Garten. Listen to Be My Guest with Ina Garten wherever you get your podcasts. Hey, it's Francis, and if you're celebrating, happy Father's Day. We made this episode last year to celebrate dads and dadhood, and how it's pretty complicated sometimes. Have a listen. I'm Francis Lamb, and this is The Splendid Table from APM. Until this spring, you know, like so many people, it'd been more than 2 full years since I'd seen my mom and dad. And when they finally came to visit, I made dinner. You know, just simple Cantonese home cooking. Like, I busted out my rice cooker, I stir-fried some greens, made some stir-fried tomatoes and eggs, and I steamed a little fish. And you know, it's funny because I don't think I'd ever tried to cook Chinese food for my parents before. You know, it's not something I really know how to do. It's not what I was trained in. But my mom, she said I had good wok hei on the greens. And my dad, who is literally the most critical person on planet Earth when it comes to the doneness of fish, said my steamed fish was, and I quote, just right. And I absolutely could not believe it, right? And, you know, never mind that I actually cooked the fish in a microwave, but it just made me so happy. It was not the validation of, oh, hey, you're a good cook, but really just the thought that I could feed my parents, and in particular, my very picky dad, food that made them happy. And this week, our whole show is about dads. Well, people and their dads. Coming up later, we'll have the food writer and podcaster Kevin Pang on with his father, Jeffrey, talking about how cooking gave them a way to save their relationship. And first, we have the absolutely wonderful duo of Kitty and Al Tate, authors of the new book, Bread Song. It's a cookbook of creative baking recipes, and it's also a memoir told by the both of them about how Kitty started to face incredibly hard mental health challenges as a young teenager a few years ago, and a random batch of bread by her father Al changed their lives. They're the owners of the Orange Bakery in Watlington, England. We're so happy to have them with us. Hey, Kitty. Hey, Al.
Oh, thank you for having us. We've been very excited about this.
This is our one of our first sort of international hookups, so it's very, very exciting.
Oh, it's, your story is in some way obviously extremely personal, but I think it's in many ways universal, so we're super happy to have you. And Kitty, let's start with you. You have, in your book, a really wonderful story about the first time you remember your father mixing up a batch of bread dough. Mm. Can you share that with us?
Yeah, so when I first watched Dad make his very first loaf, or the first loaf that I had seen him make, it was just mesmerizing to me because I had been struggling really, really badly with anxiety and depression. And I found it really hard for anything to take me out of myself and to distract me from all these thoughts, which were just constantly whirring around my brain. And then I watched Dad mix together flour, water, salt, and a tiny bit of yeast. And what it did, it looked like this gross, anemic mix. And I took the mickey out of him. I was like, oh, I'm not going to eat that. It's not going to be edible. But then the next day, this anemic, gross, gloopy mix was suddenly alive and bubbly. Mm. And he scooped it out and he put it into a tin and he baked it. And it wasn't like this amazing sourdough loaf that you see now, but it was golden and it was comforting and it made me feel safe. And this sludge, which I felt kind of represented my head and my mind, had turned into something so beautiful and delicious, and it gave me hope.
Oh, that's so wonderful. You know, I love that you say it gave you hope, because I am nowhere near an expert bread baker. But one thing I truly love about it is, you know, it kind of happens on its own time, you know? you kind of get the dough going and you just have to wait and you watch it grow and you watch it change. And it's such a small thing, but I love that idea of, you know, you're as much a caretaker of this thing as you are.
I think it's a really nice way of putting it. I think you're right. You're accompanying the bread on its journey rather than
you have a sense of duty towards it.
Yeah, and it gives you a sense of perspective, I think, for me anyway. I don't garden, but I imagine it's like how gardeners feel about watching their plants grow and change a little bit every day, right?
I think that's even slower. that's what we're aspiring to.
Yeah, that level. And one day we'll get the patience.
We'll move on to paint drying next. Yeah.
We're going to start a new paint drying business.
Yeah.
But okay, so but then can you tell me from there, from that sort of that metaphoric experience with bread, tell me about what you enjoy about the actual physical experience of making bread now.
I mean, it is incredible, bread and baking, because especially dough, because it is alive. I mean, we make sourdough now, so it's just three ingredients. But when you're handling and touching and caring for the dough, you're caring for something which is alive, and you have a sense of responsibility that you need to nurture it and that you need to be there so that in the end you'll be able to make a loaf and give it to someone who will love it and enjoy it as much as you have loved and enjoyed making it.
Yeah, I love that. And I love how you connect that to the idea of getting outside of yourself and getting outside of your own head a bit.
Yeah, and I think it's because it's been done for so many years, you also have this amazing sense of history, that you're doing something that people have been making 500 years ago or 600, and that people are doing all around the world. When I'm baking at like 5 a.m., I like to think, who else is baking at 5 a.m.? And I can imagine all these people all around the world baking, and I love that.
Oh, I love that too. And Al, you wrote that your decision to suggest making bread together was sort of a random thing, kind of a lark. Tell us about what that time was like for you and your family.
So we were a sort of classically happily dysfunctional family. and there were three children and two adults and far too many animals and a garden that probably could have done with the kind of attention that you were talking about, and life, basically. So life going on in its own sort of slightly chaotic way. The older two children were both doing exams, and so we were drawn into that. And we just we hadn't spotted the signals that Kitty was giving, and they were very subtle signals because she was very good at masking that. But there was this very happy, bubbly child who we say in the book just sort of literally had bounced her way through life, you know, bounced into rooms, bounced on our bed, bounced out of the car, stopped bouncing. And yeah, she was 14. It's not a great age to be. I seem to remember being 14 myself. Not with enormous fondness. The other two had kind of got through being 14. It's not an easy thing for today's generation coming through. So I think we sort of thought, well, you know, maybe this is something that is just sort of that kind of cloud of unease and anxiety and unhappiness. Maybe that's just a passing storm. But it wasn't, because suddenly the storm erupted into something totally unexpected, and you know, poor Kit was sort of plunged into a place that was very dark and very bleak. And it, as a family, it just brought us all to a massive stop. We knew we had to do something about this.
And I mean, I don't think anyone would be so naive as to think, oh, and then we made a loaf of bread and everything was fine. But Kitty, you mentioned that it gave you a sense of hope. And Al, for you, tell us about that moment. Did you sense even a shift, or did you sense that there was something there? And tell us about how you then, you know, grew this practice of baking together. Mm.
It was, I mean, as Kitty said, it was probably the sort of 17th thing that we tried. There have been all sorts of different things that we tried out to try and sort of give Kitty some kind of distraction. Watching paint dry probably was up there. And gardening and walking and dogs and craft and art and sewing. Nothing had really worked. And so the baking wasn't... It wasn't really a deliberate decision of thinking, well, maybe this will work. It was very coincidental. And I wish in a Disney movie, you know, the bluebirds would have been singing on my shoulder at that point when Kitty suddenly clicked, wow, this is something I'm interested in. But at the time we were so in survival mode, the fact that Kitty asked me, can I have another go at doing that, didn't really register. But Kitty being Kitty, once she decides to have another go, she has another go.
I can get a little bit obsessive.
So within, I would say probably within a day or two, it was clear something had triggered here. And Kitty was really interested and excited about baking bread. And it was the first glimmer of seeing the old Kitty and seeing something other than the Kitty who was trapped in a very bleak place. So yeah. it was a great moment. But it probably, I'd be lying if I said I knew pow straight away. It took a few days.
Sure. We're talking to Al and Kitty Tate, authors of the book Bread Song. We'll be back with more with them in a minute. I'm Francis Lamb, and this is The Splendid Table from APM. Our show is supported by Hero Bread. You know, for a lot of us, bread has been a staple all our lives. Toast at breakfast, sandwiches at lunch, a nice buttered roll at dinner. It's comforting and delicious, and bread is often what we crave. But sometimes, it can sit a little heavy after a meal. That's where Hero Bread comes in. They've created fluffy, delicious versions of the breads that we're used to, but that include no net carbs, 0 grams of sugar, and fewer calories. Oh, and there's more good stuff too, like protein and fiber. Hero Bread has everything from your daily sandwich loaf to tortillas or hot dog and hamburger buns. The products are flavorful and they have something for every craving, from a dressed-up breakfast burrito to a late-night PB&J. They even have monthly small-batch drops of indulgent treats like 2-gram net-carb Hero Croissant or the 1-gram net-carb Hero Cheddar Biscuit. Don't give up being a breadhead. Hero Bread is offering 10% off your order. Go to hero.co and use code TABLE at checkout. That's table at hero.co. Our show is supported by Be My Guest with Ina Garten, Ina's official podcast from Food Network, back for its 4th season. In every episode, Ina invites a different friend to her home to talk about life, love, and career, all while cooking an amazing meal. Listen as Ina does what she does best, make good conversation and delicious food, while making it sound fun and easy. This season, Ina dives into conversation with astronaut and colonel Nicole Mann. As Ina teaches Nicole how to make seared scallops with celery root puree, they talk about everything from family to what foods Nicole really craves when she's in space. And listen in as Ina and Pulitzer Prize-winning writer David Remnick talk about music lessons and the value of developing language skills before joining their spouses for a lively conversation over a comforting dish of chicken parmesan. If you love a good chat over a great meal, you'll love Be My Guest with Ina Garten. Listen to Be My Guest with Ina Garten wherever you get your podcasts. I'm Francis Lamb, and this is the show for curious cooks and eaters. We're celebrating fathers and their children today, and later on, we're going to be talking with filmmaker, editor, and podcast host Kevin Pang with his dad, Jeffrey, about how they came to be co-hosts of the video series Hunger Pangs. But now we're going to get back to Al and Kitty Tate, the father and daughter duo who wrote a cookbook, Bread Song, that tells the story of how learning to bake renewed their lives. Let's get back to it with them. So your book, Bread Song, is unique, right, in that about half of it is a cookbook and half of it is this story told in both of your voices alternating about your experience of, you know, opening this bakery and having this bakery and how it's intertwined with the story of dealing with mental health challenges. But there's one thing I'm really struck by too, which is that, you know, as you noted, Kitty, this story started with a deep bout of depression and anxiety, a dark place, Al, as you put it. And I'm sure those challenges never really fully go away, but there's so much joy in this story, and there's so much joy in this life and in this work. Tell us about that.
I think the thing is that depression and anxiety and all sorts of things and struggles with mental health come with this silver lining, which is you see joy because you know when it's not there. And if your day-to-day life or your normality and it's not in it and it's not there and it's absent, that when it does appear, when it does suddenly show its head, you so appreciate it. It's like when the day is always cloudy, when the sun comes out, you put your face in it and you appreciate it straight away instead of it just always being sunny.
And I think Kitty has this extraordinary capacity for sharing joy as well. So I think it's one thing to experience joy and recognize it, and that's really important. But it's another thing to be able to share and communicate that joy, whether it is in the sort of joy of her baking and what she bakes is extraordinary, or whether it's in her the way in which she shares her humor, just, you know, in everyday sense, but also on her Instagram feeds. And the way she sort of interacts with people, it's a rare gift when it's a genuine thing, which Kitty has. And it doesn't mean, as she says, that the joy is always there. You know, but when it is, yeah, she's extraordinarily good at bringing other people into that moment.
Yeah. What? I mean, I sense a lot of that too in the creativity of the recipes that you have. There's a recipe in the book that I didn't grow up with Marmite, so I don't have this personal connection to that flavor. But I think you call it the comfort bread or the comfort loaf, and it's a bread with Marmite in it. And you have all of these items that you have in this bakery that you run together now. Kitty, how do you tell us about what inspires you to create your recipes?
Yeah, so I think the hardest thing about writing the book was I could only have like 60 recipes and I had about 600. So I sometimes dream of them. Sometimes I'll be walking down different aisles in our shop, our co-op, and I'll be like, oh, cornflake bread, which we did the other day, which was very good actually. And then sometimes it'll just be reading recipe books. Sometimes it's just inspired by the flavors which make me feel happy and which make me feel safe or which make me excited. Or we're going to this place actually after this, which is called Cowley Road, and we can pick up all these amazing ingredients from these different stores. So again, I'll just walk down the aisles and I'll be like, oh, za'atar, what can we do with za'atar? Or, oh, miso, can we fold it into a loaf? So they come from left, right and centre, really. And some don't work. There have been a lot that don't work, but some do. And when they do, it feels amazing.
I think the other thing about baking and bread in particular, though, is that there's a really nice scaffolding to it. So, as Kitty says, you know, particularly with sourdough, you're just looking at three ingredients and it's the same process, essentially.
I like to think that instead of like, oh, what can you put on toast? Like, what can you put in bread?
Yeah.
I mean, what if like the bread is enough as itself and then all you have to do is butter it and you have a world of flavors instead of using it as a vehicle for flavor?
Yeah, for sure. I love that idea. And I also love that when you say, like, you know, so much of it you're talking about, it's like, oh, walking down the street or walking in a market. It's actually also about being open to the world, right?
Yes. Yeah. And that was a really big thing for me baking was I had this very small world of school, which I went to my local school in our village, and being able to bake suddenly opened up this world of like I looked at Instagram and there were these bakers from all around the world who I love to see and were loving bread just as much as I was loving bread. And then when I was going to travel, and when we do travel around to see other bakers and bakeries, you have this calling card and this purpose, which is you love bread just as much as they do. And it means that you can meet these people from complete different worlds, but have these amazing conversations because you're so in love with the same thing.
Yeah. And it's an incredibly generous community, the baking community. So, you know, they're very generous with their time, and they're generous with their tips, and they're generous with, well, they're being very generous with us in terms of, you know, a literal generosity in terms of giving us a mixer, giving us a table, giving us bannetons. But also they take you in and treat you as an equal. If you have that enthusiasm for baking, we still feel we're right at the very, very bottom of our learning curve. You know, yes, we've got a bakery and we've got a book and that's fantastic, but we're still fans basically of bread. And I think if you're a fan of bread, the baking community just goes, wow, yeah, join the club. Look what we've done. How about trying out this? And that applies, as Kitty says, thanks to social media across the world. So we'll get bakers who share their versions of what we've done, or we'll share our versions of what they've done. It's great.
Yeah. Is there a place that you remember, or a loaf that you remember tasting together for the first time in your travels, in your exploration, where you looked at each other and said, wow, this one?
Probably. So one of the big things for me is I used to find traveling really, really hard because it took me away from everything that I found safe, which was like my kitchen and my dough. But I really, really wanted to go to bakeries. And there was one bakery in particular in Paris, which I'd always dreamt of going to, called Ten Bells. And I managed to get some tickets very, very cheaply on just like deals. And I gave them to Dad for his birthday. It was a bit of a self present, I'm not going to lie. But we went and I made it there. And yes, I was struggling with my anxiety, but it was also worth it because I was suddenly surrounded by like a carb heaven. And we went to this bakery called Ten Bells and we got this loaf, and it was very similar to like the San Francisco tartine. It was really dark crusted and really moist inside and super sour. And that was the first time I'd had sourdough that wasn't like stale and 4 days old and 10 times the price of what you'd pay for a white slice. This was like fresh and delicious and just something I'd never had before. And that was a big moment for both of us. We kind of like incredible hulked it and just ripped into this loaf.
We came back a lot heavier. We're much lower center of gravity than we left. And the irony was that actually, yeah, Kid has been back there just a few months ago to work at Ten Bells for a week.
Awesome.
So yeah, it was a really nice sort of cycle that was completed there.
Yeah. Well, Al, let me ask you this. You know, I have a child. I have a daughter. She's quite a bit younger. She's still, you know, she's still in primary school. But every time I see her get interested in something and excited about something, I feel this like jolt. I feel this excitement too, right? And so far, it's not been like the kind of interest that I would pick up myself or carry myself. You know, she's really into like these children's books, or she's really into, you know, picking up her crayons and drawing and something like that. But there is something I think about, that sort of frisson of excitement when you see someone you love and someone you, you know, are caring for, you know, gravitate towards something. So tell me about you and your relationship with this interest in bread and baking. Is this something that you're like, oh wow, I'm super into it too? Is it something that, wow, Kitty's into it and I want to be here for her and with her? Like, tell me about your relationship to this whole sort of learning journey.
Well, I'm a child of the 70s, and also a child of a truly staggeringly bad cook. So my mother, I can say this because I don't think she's going to be tuning in to the US. But you never know.
The internet is anyway, forever.
But she really was inventive in all the worst sorts of ways. And so the one safe place and safe space was bread. You know, she couldn't affect that. Well, she could burn a loaf pretty spectacularly. But yeah, so growing up, I was one of four children, and I would say 90% of our diet was toast.
I mean, what has changed?
Well, exactly. I set the pattern there for myself. And then
I mean, 98 some days.
So I've always loved bread and toast. But, you know, this is terrible white sliced plastic bread, but it still was great. And then I started baking when I was a student. But I defy the whole Malcolm Gladwell maxim. And I've probably put in 10,000 hours over time. Baking loaves, and they just got worse and worse and worse. They just became these really heavy, dark, grey brioche blocks, and they either had too much salt or too little salt, and they sort of sat there like a hulk, and the children would be very polite when they were still warm and you could melt a bit of butter on them, but after that they were just rejects.
We'd be having lunch and Dad would bring like a pile of white slice to the table and then a pile of his bread, and we'd all just reach for the white slice and leave this like homemade bread in the corner.
It was you know, it's the wrong kind of frisson. And then I found this method. The other reason I was banned from baking bread, because we had a very small kitchen, and I used to make so much mess, sort of apocalyptic amounts of
flour. We had a table that we couldn't even see the bottom of. It was just like a layer of dough.
So basically, I wasn't allowed to make bread. And then I read about Jim Leahy's method, which is a sort of no-knead method, but also in brackets, it said no mess. And and it's true, you know, and it was exactly what Kitty said. You know, you mix up these four ingredients, tiniest amount of yeast, and you let the yeast do its stuff. You leave it overnight. You scoop it out in the morning. You pop it in a casserole dish or in a loaf tin, let it prove, and it's incredible. And that was the method I taught Kitty. But basically, I feel I'm still on this amazing sort of learning journey. I don't have Kitty's. She's so instinctive with bread.
You mean slightly impulsive?
Well, impulsive and instinctive. And Kitty's very good with animals, and this is basically another animal. So she knows if it's a little bit cold, or if it needs to be wrapped up, or if it needs to be popped to bed. You know, she'll have that understanding very intuitively, whereas I'm a little bit more mechanical. But I get a lot of chances to have a go at it.
Yeah.
So I'm getting there. I'm getting there.
You're definitely getting there.
So, Kitty, what is it like to have a bakery, a business with your father, and also have him be your creative apprentice?
I mean, I'm slightly frustrated this is going to be recorded, because it means that it'll be there forever. But I love working. I love working with my dad, because it isn't really working with your dad. It's not really like I'm working with my dad. It's like I'm working with this man who's also my best friend, and he's my business partner, and he's a good listener. But also, I have a slightly strange mind, which can work far too quickly sometimes. But all I have to do is say the syllables, and Dada knows exactly what I'm talking about or what I'm trying to say. And he also lets me be as creative as I want. But I move very fast, so I can leave a lot of gaps, which he's very good at filling. I will see an end goal, and I'll want to get there straight away. Dad's very good at quickly building in the scaffolding so that I don't just fall down.
That's lovely. And Al, what is it? What's it like for you to have gone on this journey, and now, you know, you're in this place where you're, you know, running a business together, and you're obviously, as a father and daughter, your lives were intertwined, but intertwined in a very different way now.
Yeah, absolutely. And I think there's very few obvious models for how that's meant to work. I think there's lots of models for the sort of traditional hierarchical, you know, I'm the adult here and you're not, and therefore you'll do what I say kind of mode of behavior. And this is utterly different because, as Kitty says, we work so closely on so many levels, but there is what I never realized was how similar we are. You know, we
both pale and ginger.
Yeah.
And short.
Short, pale and ginger. Kitty's got hair.
You've got it.
In the right places.
Just not on your head.
You know, in terms of our sort of creativity and in terms of the way we spin off on tangents and the way we can both make things actually happen, we're very simple. We're very simple people.
We are very simple people, but we're also very similar. People.
And I think I feel it's been an extraordinary privilege because I wouldn't have discovered this had things not happened the way they have. You know, I wouldn't wish it on anyone, but I sort of feel I've been the lucky one here because
I'm happy this is being recorded now.
But I've had this chance to sort of get to know Kitty in a way that I never would have been able to, and probably get to know myself in a way that perhaps I wouldn't have been able to know. So, yeah, it's an interesting one.
Mm. Yeah, that's so lovely. Thank you both so much for coming in today.
Oh, not at all. It's a real pleasure.
Yeah, it's a real pleasure. And we hope to one day be able to go to America and visit, so.
Come by. We're still here for now.
We just need to sell a bit more bread.
Kitty and Al Tate are the authors of Bread Song, How Baking Changed Our Lives. You can find a recipe for Kitty's fika buns at splendidtable.org. Coming up, it's the Pangs. Kevin and his father Jeffrey and the story of cooking their way back together. I'm Francis Lamb, and this is The Splendid Table from APM. Our show is supported by Hero Bread. You know, for a lot of us, bread has been a staple all our lives. Toast at breakfast, sandwiches at lunch, a nice buttered roll at dinner. It's comforting and delicious, and bread is often what we crave. But sometimes it can sit a little heavy after a meal. That's where Hero Bread comes in. They've created fluffy, delicious versions of the breads that we're used to, but that include no net carbs, 0 grams of sugar, and fewer calories. Oh, and there's more good stuff too, like protein and fiber. Hero Bread has everything from your daily sandwich loaf to tortillas or hot dog and hamburger buns. The products are flavorful, and they have something for every craving, from a dressed-up breakfast burrito to a late-night PB&J. They even have monthly small-batch drops of indulgent treats like 2-gram net carb Hero croissant or the 1-gram net carb Hero cheddar biscuit. Don't give up being a breadhead. Hero Bread is offering 10% off your order. Go to hero.co and use code TABLE at checkout. That's TABLE at hero.co. I'm Francis Lamb, and this is The Splendid Table from APM. I've known Kevin Pang for years, first as a great food features writer for the Chicago Tribune, and then as a filmmaker, editor, and now a podcast host. He's been telling wonderful human stories about food for as long as I've known him. But then one day, a few years ago, I saw him write about himself and his dad. It was this wild little story, actually, in the New York Times, about how he found out that his dad had been quietly racking up millions of views of cooking videos he started putting up on YouTube. And I don't want to spoil the whole story here, but it was just one of those things that made you realize that for some people, you know, the parent they've known literally their whole life still has untold stories for you to draw out of them. Kevin and his father, Jeffrey Pang, are with us. But before we start, I should also tell you that as a son of Cantonese parents, you'll probably hear me address Mr. Pang as uncle, even though we're not actually related. It's just how I was brought up, you know? Anyway, Kevin, Mr. Pang, welcome.
Thanks, Francis. It's great to be here.
You know, this is so funny, but I literally just yesterday was sitting with my dad, and he told me this random thing, which was that many years ago, he lived in Illinois, and he was in this apartment where they had no air conditioning, and it would get so hot in the summer that the only way he could sleep was to open the refrigerator and go sleep next to the refrigerator, which is A, hilarious, and B, sounds really bad from a safety perspective. But I also kind of realized, you know, I am well into my 40s, and
I have absolutely no idea what my dad's life was like before he was my dad. So when I read your story first, Kevin, many years ago, and then heard the wonderful podcast you made about it, about how, you know, the two of you didn't have necessarily the most communicative relationship when you were younger, I feel like I got it. But can you tell us what your relationship with each other was like when you were growing up, Kevin?
You know, Francis, as you're saying that, I was just nodding my head because I thought I was the only one. But, you know, amongst all the Asian friends that I have and Chinese friends in particular, there is a sense of that. I think there is a sense of, and I can't say this for everyone, but you don't quite know what your parents do. And I think like you, I get it in dribs and drabs. Like I have the vaguest understanding of what my parents did for a living. But if you ask me specifically what they did, I don't think I can still tell you to this day. So I'm actually glad that you said that. But, you know, it's not something where like I didn't want to know about it. It's just that it never came up. We only talked about, you know, I talked about homework and video games and eating. And it just was not something that was brought up.
Yeah. It's kind of talk about what's right in front of you. Uncle, is that how you remember it also?
I think our relationship is not very close, you know, because it's very hard for me to express myself in English. English is my second language, especially when I'm communicating with Kevin. I have to switch to speak English because Kevin didn't like to speak in Chinese. So,
yeah, I feel like that's a problem for a lot of I feel like I'm not an isolated incident. I know that a lot of my friends had the same issues. And look, when you're moving from a place where you spoke Chinese, you know, every day, all the time, to a place where your friends and your peers and your school and your teacher don't speak it and you're trying your best to fit in. I think that's just naturally what happens. I don't think there's any malice behind it, but, you know, when your environment changes, then that's what happens.
Yeah, totally. Uncle, what was your relationship with your father like?
Oh, we're very close, you know. My father is a teacher in high school. And because in the 50s, in Hong Kong, you know, everybody is so poor. But everybody's relation is very close. My parents always taught me so many things, you know, like, you know, how to cook and how to paint, you know, even how to clean up. And because my father is a teacher, probably he know how to communicate with me. I'm not a teacher, but I'm a very traditional man. I don't think any kid would like to, you know, to learn any Confucius things, you know, from the parents, right? So I'm sometimes, maybe I'm too traditional, probably. And I don't speak good English. So that's why my son, maybe he didn't understand what I expressed. Maybe he got some misunderstanding sometimes. Okay. So that is the problem.
Yeah.
Anyway, my relation with my parents is excellent. I love my father.
Yeah.
I always miss my father right now, even.
Kevin, I remember reading in your story, too, that part of it was, you know, the sort of cultural and language gap. But part of it, too, was I think you wrote that you felt like, you know, you didn't have a lot of common interests for a long time, and that started change when you got a job as a food writer, as a food reporter for the Chicago Tribune. Tell us about how you got that job and what drew you to it? Because you were a hard news guy before.
Yeah, totally. I never thought I wanted to be a food writer. It happened quite accidentally. I wanted to be a reporter on the cops beat. I wanted to be covering wars. I wanted to be an investigative reporter. And so one day when the features department editor at the Chicago Tribune said, hey, we're launching this new weekend section. We want some younger voices. And I think younger voices is really journalism code for we want to pay you a little bit less than our tenured reporters, right? So you know how it is, right? I said, sure, why not? And I never expected in a million years to write about food. I didn't know that I was interested in it. But I think the fact that just being Chinese and, as you know, Francis, when you meet someone from Hong Kong, you don't say hello. You say, have you eaten yet? Like, that's our way that we greet each other, right? And so the fact that food is so ingrained in our DNA, I think that's where I naturally gravitated towards food. And, you know, who would have thought that I would still be doing it some 16, 17 years later? I certainly didn't.
Yeah. But Uncle, what did you think when he took that job? Did you think, oh, this was an opportunity to have something in common? Because I know how much you love food.
Oh, actually, I never thought anything about that. You know, I because, you know, Kevin just live in Chicago. I live in Seattle. We don't talk all the time. We just talking about weather, Costco, you know. Mm-hmm. So he changed, you know, his career. Our relationship get much closer after he worked for the food industry because we have a common topic to talk. He called me more and we talk about cooking and food. I think our relationship also changed is because Kevin got married and he have his own son, Liam. I think Kevin now understand more how I feel and why I am always so worried about my kid as a father. Yeah, so we'll always behave like a father, think too much and worry too much. But I'm so glad we are much closer right now.
Yeah. Uncle, how did you learn to cook? You mentioned that your mother taught you.
My mother taught me a lot of cooking because my mother is a very talented woman from a rich family in Guangzhou. She learned by herself, okay? And I remember, you know, when I was young, she always take me to the market and teach me how to buy, you know, veggie, how to buy fish, how to buy meat. And I love to watch my mother's cooking. I was 6 or 7. As a kid, you know, we didn't have TV or any toys. I watched my mother's how to turn a live fish, a piece of the raw meat or tofu, adding scallion, like ginger, you know, and it becomes a delicious dish, just like a miracle to me, anyway. So it's a magic. It's a magic. So that's why, you know, I love to cook.
Yeah. Kevin, did you know that growing up?
I never knew about my father being taken to the market by my grandma when he was 5 years old. I mean, my kid is 6, so I just can't imagine taking my kid to the wet market and like absorbing and learning and finding everything around him being magical. I mean, the first time I heard about this was when I first talked to my father when I was interviewing him for the podcast that I did for America's Test Kitchen. Mm-hmm. And just now when he responded that my grandma came from a wealthy family, I never knew this. I mean, like, it's very strange to say this, but Francis, like, this is the first time that I heard about this. And, not because I never wanted to know, but just because it never came up. Yeah. And so, it's kind of strange to hear that story and hear that detail about my grandma's life for the first time, live on the radio.
Well, okay, so take us to another moment of discovery, which is when you found out your father was a YouTube star.
Yeah, that was weird. Yeah. I mean, so, you know, this was about 10, 11 years ago, and my mother had sent me an email. Actually, no, I think my dad sent me an email first. And, you know, it says, from Jeffrey Pang forward, you know, check out this video. And you know what happens.
Which is always just delete.
Yeah. Exactly. Like, I didn't even think much of it. And then a few weeks later, my mother called me up and said, hey, have you seen this video that your dad is doing? And I'm like, no. should I? And she said, yeah, you should take a look. And it was a video of my mom and dad demonstrating how to make Shanghainese green scallion pancakes, the crispy scallion pancakes. And I started looking through the channel, and it had, you know, you expected to have like 17, 18 views. I forgot what it was, but it was in the tens of thousands. And then I started looking at the other videos on there, and there was over a million views on YouTube. And so I was completely gobsmacked.
And Uncle, why did you start making those videos?
Because I hope to let more people, especially my children, to learn about our family's cooking.
Yeah.
Me and Catherine, my wife, always thinking, you know, if someday, if we are not around, at least they can watch our video to learn how to cook.
Hmm.
It's interesting that the way my father was effectively communicating with me was through cooking. And that transcends any language barriers.
Yeah.
I mean, in a way, he's communicating to my generation in a way that my generation is spoken to, which is through YouTube and through social media. So, you know, in retrospect, I think that's a very clever and ultimately a very effective way of communicating with your children, is to talk to them where they're being spoken to.
Yeah, totally. Kevin, have you made the scallion pancake?
I have. I am slightly embarrassed to say that I made the America's Test Kitchen version of green scallion pancake.
I know.
But you know what? I have made plenty of other dishes, you know, that I only remember as something that I ate growing up, because we didn't eat green scallion pancakes every single week, right? But anyway, I did not make the green scallion pancake. I should, though, because I feel like I would be a traitor if I only did the version for my work. Sorry, Dad.
Okay. Well, since you are dead set on plugging your work, let's go there. Because now you and your father actually make a series of cooking videos together for ATK. What's that been like?
Yeah, maybe I should ask my dad first. What do you think? Do you remember what you said when I first told you I wanted to do this?
So you call me and ask me, are you interested to do a cooking video with me? I said, what? The show like Iron Chef? And Kevin said, of course no. But it's in a studio and framed by a professional team. Anyway, when he told me the name of the show will be Hunger Pangs, with the family name Pang, oh, I know my father will be very, very proud too in the heaven. Anyway, I'm so glad I have that chance to cook with my son.
Yeah.
I have to say that I feel like it's meant to be. Like, if I did not call it Hunger Pangs, there's no reason for me to exist on this earth, if not for the title of a YouTube show.
What was the favorite episode that you've done together?
I really enjoyed learning about fried rice, because fried rice is something that is, you know, it's like the blues. There's no set way of playing the blues. Mm-hmm. You know, there's a certain chord progression, but you can fill it with different licks, fill it with different, you know, trills and whatnot. Learning about fried rice and learning that you want to use not fresh rice, but day-old rice because it's drier, and how moisture is the enemy of fried rice. The idea of sprinkling rice over the wok as if like you're trying to make, you know, like a snowstorm, right? And like that way of making the rice more granular, something I learned from my dad. I thought that was really interesting. Learning about the progression which you added the ingredients. You put the eggs in first versus putting it in last, about putting the vegetables and the tassio, the barbecue pork in a certain order. That was completely fascinating to me. And so, you know, I felt like that episode in particular was arming me with the tools in the toolbox to actually make Chinese food. So for that reason, I think that was my favorite episode.
Yeah, I love that. And what have you learned about each other while working on this together?
Oh, wow. You know, I mean, look, when you're filming, and I know you've certainly been through these TV shoots before, Francis, what you see at the end are 7 minutes of highly edited, highly polished, all the mistakes taken out. So you see a very clean version of it. But what you don't see is that those 7 minutes took about 5 hours to film. And there's a lot of starts, a lot of stops, and a lot of, you know, a lot of patience running low, especially when you're near episode 7. You sort of want to kind of get it over with, right? So, I mean, I think it's not so much about learning about each other, but more lessons in life was, you know, understanding that, look, you're filming with a 70-year-old man whose first language is not English, and that's going to be difficult. So I think really, you know, the thing that I learned most and that I'm going to apply to the rest of my life is this idea of empathy, you know, like walking a mile in someone's shoes and understanding how difficult it is for this person, how nerve-wracking it is to speak in a language that is not yours. So, you know, I think I probably gained a better sense of empathy throughout this process.
Yeah. Uncle, what have you learned while doing these videos?
Yes, you know, I totally agree. You know, Kevin is more patient and he's more caring about me. He always bring me tea and grab a chair for me to sit and ask me, are you hungry? I think just in a couple of hours, he called me there, you know, much more than the last couple of years. I really appreciate and thank you, Kevin, anyway.
Yeah. Well, I should add, too, that, you know, not to put a damper on this very sweet moment. I think, look, we still fight and we still get into arguments and we still snipe at each other. But I think, you know, I just think there's just greater understanding. And, I mean, look, I think it's got to be a thrill for my father to be, you know, recognized. I mean, at least I'm not saying he's recognized like Martin Yan is, right? But he's certainly recognized it around the ATK offices. I remember a couple of people stopping him and saying just how much they enjoyed him in the show. And, you know, when you think you're long retired and sort of your best years are behind you, I think when you get that sort of validation, that's got to be a nice thing. And, you know, I'm sort of glad that he's getting that at this stage in his life.
Wow. Yeah. Well, thank you both so much. It's been so lovely talking with you. Happy Father's Day.
Yeah, thanks so much, Francis. Happy Father's Day.
Thank you.
Kevin Pang and Jeffrey Pang are the hosts of America's Test Kitchen's videos on Chinese cooking called Hunger Pangs. If you want to learn more about their story, you should check out the podcast Proof. There's an episode about them, and it's just totally great. And that's our show for the week. And hey, if you're a dad, or if you have a dad or a dad figure in your life, have a terrific Father's Day. Talk to you next week. APM Studios are run by Chandra Kavati, Alex Schaffert, and Joanne Griffith. Beth Perlman's our executive producer, and The Splendid Table was created by Sally Swift and Lynn Rosetto Casper. It's made every week by technical producer Jennifer Lukey, producer Erica Romero, digital producer James Napoli, and managing producer Sally Swift. I'm Francis Lamb, and this is APM Studios.
All over the country,
we need to improve reading in Wisconsin.
Schools are changing the way they teach reading.
I'm calling for a renewed focus on literacy.
We have gotten this wrong in New York and all across the nation.
And it's happening because of a podcast.
I think your podcast has changed my life.
And I'm going to share this podcast with everyone I meet.
Sold a Story investigates how teaching kids to read went wrong. New episodes of Sold a Story are available now.